We are on paper 113, section 5, which is old, single column, page 1245. And this section 5 picks up, you know, right where they left off with the themes in the previous section. So there's really, not much to say in advance of that. And maybe just one thing for those who come in late, there's can someone help with the folding chairs over here for those people?
This is not safe.
Okay.
There's a seat over here.
All right. Let's let's see if we can settle in and do it silently while we're going here. Okay, section 5.
Seraphic ministry to mortals. Angels do not invade the sanctity of the human mind. They do not manipulate the will of mortals. Neither do they directly contact with the indwelling adjusters. The guardian of destiny influences you in every possible manner consistent with the dignity of your personality. Under no circumstances do these angels interfere with the free action of the human will. Neither angels nor any other order of universe personality have power or authority to curtail or abridge the prerogatives of the human choosing. Angels are so near you and care so feelingly for you that they figuratively weep because of your woeful intolerance and stubbornness. Seraphim do not shed physical tears. They do not have physical bodies, but neither do they possess wings. But they do have spiritual emotions, and they do experience feelings and sentiments of a spiritual nature which are in certain ways comparable to human emotions.
Let's just pause there for a second. The beginning there, they're picking up on what they pointed out. They want to reemphasize that important issue, the difference between how the seraphim are engaging you relative to how the adjusters are engaging you. The adjusters are definitely engaging you in father-like fashion. You know, they're a direct injection into your mind, injection into place. But the seraphim, as guardian angels or guardians of destiny, are definitely in the God the Mother mode, they're surrounding you. Remember how they, talked about that right at the end of the previous section, enveloping. They used. So again, they want to just reemphasize that. Also, like they said up in that previous section, they're definitely engaging the environment. Not you. And that whole bit every possible manner, they're going to be engaging you, because remember how they pointed out how nonstop, that action is.
Unremitting.
Unremitting, exactly. It's interesting here what they do in this second paragraph, that quote-unquote in there, weep because of your willful intolerance and stubbornness. It's interesting that they're invoking Jeremiah there. That's, a rephrasing of the statement of Jeremiah when he's warning, his fellow Judeans that if they don't turn around, if their arrogance and pride are not curtailed, Jerusalem is going to fall. The hand of favor will be withdrawn, you know, at least for a time. You know, we all know we had the exile there. That's what you know. What that's why that's in quotes. You know, it's not, you know, the passage in the Bible is not speaking of angels. You know, it's Jeremiah saying he will weep. But, you know, just like we pointed out, you know, just a couple times ago, they often are using, you know, very apropos expressions in the Bible like that, you know, to make a point. You know, it's interesting just to think of how there's a very nice little parallel between that passage in Jeremiah where he's, you know, a warning of the fall of Jerusalem and says, woe unto you, and then speaks of weeping. You have a similar thing when you go forward to Jesus. You know, he's just done the woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, you know, and he's telling the women, you know, weep, you know, don't weep for me, weep for you and your children. Because Jerusalem is about to fall again. And so the tie between the use of the word woe and the use of the, you know, the word weep, you know, is in both those spots. And, you know, so it's a definite theme, see, that they can pick up on, you know, and point out, you know, if you want to really think about who is right there so immediate and intimate with you, you know, that they figuratively weep, you know, it is the angels. You know, like they said, become very, very attached to us. You know, think of the angels that were so attached to the people, you know, of Palestine. You know, and they saw it twice. You know, and of course the final horrendous time, post Michael. So, they're trying to purposely use that because of all the intense poignancy, you know, in the Bible. Stories, you know, that are tied to that idea, and you know, they want you, you know, they want that to be invoked in your mind in this context. It's that deeply that they feel. It's just another great example of how they utilize the biblical passages and how they also expect you to recognize that, expect you to immediately have all that context in your mind. As you read this, to really appreciate what they're trying to get across. You know, but never, ever do they say, okay, you know, and there's no footnote. Here's what you're supposed to be thinking in this paragraph. You know, they always are expecting you to be really, really up to speed on all that has gone before you, because they are. You know, they made themselves fully aware of everything that humans had ever done and thought and written, you know. You know, and they're building on that context.
The human emotion.
The seraphim?
Yeah. The seraphim act in your behalf quite independent of your direct appeals. They are executing the mandates of their superiors, and thus they function regardless of your passing whims or changing words. This does not imply that you may not make their tasks either easier or more difficult, but rather that angels are not directly concerned with your appeals or with your prayers.
Now, just look. Think of the splendid contrast between that and what we just, again, in the previous section, you know, when they were pointing out, you know, that beautiful, allusion to, you know, the two wings, you know, from your core of your being, you know, and how they foster that relationship between, you know, the core of your being and the self. And how that often, leads to the impulse to pray because of this, you know, engagement of you, even though it's indirect. So think about, you know, what they're saying there. They, which is first and which is second. Their actions may bring on the... an urge in you to pray, but It's not the other way around. They're ceasing. You know, their actions may bring on the impulse to pray, but your prayer does not bring on their actions. You know, it's the exact opposite of what humans have so long imagined because of their magical notion about prayer. I mean, you know, actually, really no notion of prayer. It's, you know, it's a notion of magic. You know, and that, you know, how the remember how the Revelators are really trying to point that out in, you know, on several spots about true prayer, you know, is not what you've always thought. It's not magic. You know, and right here is just a repeat of that. Your prayers do not cause the action of the angels. But the action of the angels may very well cause you to have the urge to pray. Because, you know, after all, what are their actions? In following this leading, you are sure to encounter, and if you have the courage to traverse, the rugged hills of moral choosing and spiritual progress. You know, they're not, you know, we often say they're the speed bumps that the angels build. You know, but what's the actual word that they use in that sense? It's not speed bumps. It's rugged hills, okay? Giant, you know, suspension destroying speed bumps. You know, you can forget about your oil pan and the transmission and the whole works. You know, that's what kind of stuff they're building. You know, so, you know, you may very well, you know, be have the urge to, you know, deliver me from these trials. It's like, you know, but no, they're causing those trials. They're not going to deliver you from them. The whole point is for you to muster up the courage and the spiritual strength, grab a hold of the spiritual strength to endure those rugged hills as the guardians of your destiny, not of your present.
What is that saying, feast on and fatten?
Yeah.
Feast on
and fatten on discipline.
Fatten on discipline.
Yep.
Ensues in the face of the parent. Invigorate.
And the fun thing about that quote is always to see who's memorized it.
Well, I have an afterthought to it. Let's fatten up, folks.
We're all working on it. Anyway, so just notice how there's a number of spots is that they're really playing these two sections off each other. They want you to put those two, you know, mentions of prayer together and notice what they imply together. You know, they purposely don't put them in adjacent paragraphs. They do put them in adjacent sections, at least. You know, it's not like one is in paper 5 and one's in paper 195 or something. You know, which they do sometimes. But you know, they really want you to play, you know, these together so that you can see the truth there. And notice how that, you know, seeing those two together changes the way you think about your life and how you'll live your life. You know, you're gonna turn it around. You're gonna get out of that mode of, you know, thinking of God and His angels as, you know, as something that you can manipulate with the right incantation, you know, to bring you ease.
The other thing to consider is the inevitabilities, of course.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, so that's another way of thinking about it. What are the angels? You know, they are the agents of the inevitabilities. Yeah.
In the life of the flesh, the intelligence of angels is not directly available to mortal men. They are not overlords or directors. They are simply guardians. The seraphim guard you. They do not seek directly to influence you. You must chart your own course. These angels then act to make the best possible use of the course you have chosen. They do not, ordinarily, arbitrarily intervene in the routine affairs of human life. But when they receive instructions from their superiors to perform some unusual exploit, you may rest assured that these guardians will find some means of carrying out these mandates. They do not, therefore, intrude into the picture of human drama except in emergencies, and then usually on the direct orders of their superiors. They are the beings who are going to follow you for many an age, and they are thus receiving an introduction to their future work. Personality association.
Just, you know, notice that, how, again, the careful wording, and this is a very, very common thing that they do. Lots of places in the book that they say things like, you know, they add the qualifier directly. You know, you see that in the life of the flesh, the intelligence of angels is not directly available to mortal men. And also, let's see, where's that other one? There was another one where they, I lost it. Oh, here. They do not seek directly to influence you. Okay. They often do that. They'll be saying, now these master physical controllers just don't have anything directly to do with life. On the first reading, you might not actually pick up on the word directly, and you're thinking, okay, just having to do with life, okay. So, you sort of just forget about that. But then you should be asking yourself, except if they have nothing to do with life, why is this entire paragraph about life? Oh, wait a minute. There's a word directly in there, isn't there? Yeah, they don't have anything directly to do with life, but they have everything indirectly to do with life. They often do that. It's a technique that they use to try to get you to open that other eye. If your spiritual consciousness eye is the only one's open, and paragraphs all blur into one word basically, you need to open that other individuality consciousness eye, that material consciousness eye. Start to notice, that preposition is important. Is it of or to or in or at or because it's often entirely significant. So here's another one. Like they said at the beginning, they don't directly influence you, but they do everything that they can think of to indirectly influence you. Unremitting, indirect influence.
Seraphim are able to function as material ministers to human beings under certain circumstances, but their action in this capacity is very rare. They are able, with the assistance of the midway creatures and the physical controllers, to function in a wide range of activities in behalf of human beings, even to make actual contact with mankind, but such occurrences are very unusual. In most instances, the circumstances of the material realm proceed unaltered by seraphic action, although occasions have arisen involving jeopardy to vital links in the chain of human evolution in which seraphic guardians have acted, and properly, on their own initiative.
A couple of things to notice in here. You notice how they emphasize and re-emphasize, very rare. And there's a little factual point that ties in with that. And they tell you that with the assistance of the midway creatures and the physical controllers. Does anyone know why the midway creatures have to be involved?
Because they can turn knobs.
You have an answer right here.
Yeah.
Because they're more able to connect directly with the material realm.
Well, there's definitely that. But notice the context is, for instance, let's see, where does it say? Somewhere in here where they actually, sometimes actually make themselves directly manifest. Okay, let's say in a seraphim actually wants to make themselves visible. They can't do that on their own, and a midwayer can't do that for them either. Okay, they need a master physical controller, to basically create a visualization of them. So why do you need the midway creatures? The key is that seraphim can't directly engage master physical controllers. Seraphim, cherubim, even primary midwayers can't engage directly, communicate, engage with the master physical controllers. Only the secondary midwayers can. So if the seraphim wants the master physical controller to do something, he needs a midwayer to talk, to convey the message to the master physical controller. Okay, so that's the really key thing there. In issues like they're kind of alluding to at the end, one obvious thing involving the jeopardy of vital links. Reservists would be an obvious instance of that, where a reservist needs to be involved in something, you know, and so they can't die or whatever, or they need help or something. You know, and midwares, of course, are, you know, secondary midwares are directly in charge of interacting with the reservists. So, you know, they would be playing a very direct material engagement role in a setting like that. But just, you know, little issues like that, I think, you know, and there's, you know, it's not right here, it's way back when they're talking about the, you know, ministering spirits in the local universe, and remember they sort of as an aside say, well, you're not actually ministering spirits, but the midway creatures kind of fit into the, you know, this picture, and it's in there that they make that point, you know, that the primaries can engage the spiritual and the morontial controllers, but only the secondaries can engage the physical controllers.
One of the creatures, whether it be, if they're going to protect somebody, mm-hmm. And you feel like a force is against you, but you don't see anything, would that be just the energy of them? Because they could actually, how would that work? I mean, because I know that that's a possibility, that they could actually come in contact with a human being. You can't see them physically,
right.
But you can feel this
right.
energy presence.
Right, and they wouldn't have to make themselves necessarily manifest. You know, when the midwayer made the writing on the wall back in, you know, the Daniel story, you know, it was just writing was on the wall. There was no midwayer standing there with a pen, you know, doing the writing. You know, or they weren't visible as they're rolling the stone back or whatever. You know, they can, you know, these beings can definitely do things without being totally manifest. In that regard, you know, I've tried to point this out a number of times. It's so important to take what they say very directly and think about the consequences of it. This is a good example right here of this. They emphasize and re-emphasize very unusual, not just unusual, very unusual, not just rare, very rare. Okay, and if that for no other reason, there's only a handful of secondary midwares. Okay. This, you know, and they're basically, if they're going to be the hand, you know, that's not their, you and I are not their job. Reservists are their job. You know, it's, you know, and so it's very important to notice how they emphasize this and recognize there's this big, glaring, unanswered question. Everyone knows that it's an extremely common story and that it's obviously not just everyone's delusions or wishful thinking, that run-of-the-mill humans seem to have had some sort of an intervention thing where, you know, they felt, you know, something on their shoulder, you know, and it kept them from stepping out into traffic or whatever. You know, and it can't be the seraphim and the midwayer. It's because that's an extremely common story, and this is a very rare explanation for that possibility. You know, and as I've tried to point out, I mean, if you think about it, that's why you can't help but wonder about the one very subtle statement that they make in the entire book. They say, now there's an order of angels that are even lower than the cherubim that are like the secondary midwares, very, very close to you in energetic nature. But we cannot talk about them.
Where's that?
That's it. That's in the Secrets of Seraphington, right? The end of the Secrets of Seraphington paragraph. You know, and it's so, you know, it's, and you note that. You know, and if you're uncertain, you know, it says that they can't talk about them. It's like, well, how do you know that they're actually, you know, an angelic, you know, or not an angelic, but lower than, you know, the normal angels that they're talking about? Well, one other little indirect thing, when you go to the personalities of the grand universe, and you've gotten that first list, that paradise list, yeah, and they list the angels, they start at Supernafim, and they go down in hierarchical order, seraphim, cherubim, unrevealed. Okay. One notch below. Okay. I mean, obviously there's not going to be a direct statement in the book that you can point to because they tell you point blank they can't make that direct statement. It would be a violation of the revelatory mandate. know, in addition to, akin to a betrayal of trust, as they say up there in the Saravian section. You know, but just put two and two together, you know, it's extremely likely that's what you're talking about. There's a whole order of angels to deal with the bulk of humanity on any mortal sphere. And they're so close to us that, you know, that you, we could almost perceive them, you know, it says. And so that would be the likely answer to all of those billions and billions of stories, you know, throughout all of time, you know, some of a possible intervention. And then, of course, you know, they mentioned also in that paragraph that they don't even, you know, the author of that doesn't even, you know, understand all of this phenomenon. You know, because think about how mysterious it is to all of us. You know, we all know someone has a story that it seems like something intervened and kept them from dying. You know, but then there's 100 stories where no one intervened and they were hit by the truck.
Right.
Okay. Right. Why? No one can figure it out. Well, they you know, they're basically telling you, I think they don't understand it either. It's very mysterious. It's a hand of supremacy. You know, in the whole grand scheme of things, you know, death is irrelevant. You know, it's the question of how it all plays together at any given moment relative to supremacy.
You know, the mother spirit, then, speaking as a mother, I mean, if I was the mother, making her like a human, I would be protecting all my children. You know, that just, I would be right there watching everything, make sure they don't get hurt. And so when it's, so you know she's there watching everything. And then the ones that she lets go,
it's okay.
Just, you know, it's okay.
Because, of course, she's not really letting them go.
Yeah.
You know, you cannot fall. You know, we try to keep, you know, the important, most important thing to bring into that whole conundrum about why some live and some die is that, you know, death is not a falling. You cannot fall. There's an infinite upholder. There's no cracks. There's no edges. It's impossible to fall. The only thing that can occur is you can choose to not be held. And that's it. It's impossible to fall. Absolutely impossible to fall. Yeah. You know, so you bring that to bear, that great truth to bear when you try to come to terms with the conundrum, you know, of why one soldier lived and the rest of his buddies died and those sorts of things.
I had something come up recently that I've never run across before in ministry where it was someone who knew about the Mansion Worlds and the Universe Adventure. He said that he thought it was strange that all your Rancho Book readers assume that everybody wants to go on that adventure.
Yeah, well, of course, and, you know, we got to know that. I mean, right. Even on the Mansion Worlds, many choose to not go on that adventure.
Right.
It's more surprising.
His point was that he didn't really think he wanted to go any further. He was sort of done.
More room for us? That makes sense.
But he wasn't particularly impressed. He wasn't, you know, in a hard luck case. He didn't seem to be, you know, bummed out or anything. He just thought it just seemed like a hell of a lot of work.
Yeah, well, of course, it's post-Pentecost, so guess what? You know, you're not an, you know, he's not iniquitous. He'll be resurrected. You know, he doesn't have, you know, the scope of consciousness to make the supreme choice for oblivion yet. You know, ignorance is, you know, is not damnation.
Before I had read the book enough to comprehend all of the and it's so many of them that it's hard to remember them all at once, but all the comments about the choice of life and what you have to do and what is sin and what isn't sin and all the things that go so far beyond what most of us are raised with. But if somebody has lived a really difficult life, I won't go into details, but just imagine somebody who nothing ever went right and it was even worse than that, and you tell them they can live forever. Well, they don't know what that means because they've never seen it. So in my mind, in my way of thinking, it's like everybody's going to get one true chance.
Probably wouldn't help
by the father's will, to the father's standard, not to what we might, or some human might consider a chance to make an informed decision. And I was satisfied with that for about 35 years or so, and then there's an addendum. It's the picturing, standing there, and telling God that he doesn't know what he's talking about, and that there's really nothing there for you, and you're going to convince God that you have no worth in you. You may still pass from life, but you're going to convince God that there's no worth. And that's the part. I don't know how you communicate that to someone, but we still, if we're in that situation, need to try.
Yeah, and you know, there's just so many catch-22s to that. I mean, like you're saying, you know, they had a really difficult life. You know, they don't have any desire to continue on with that struggle. Well, it's probably not going to be a comfort to them to tell them that when they wake up on the first match world, they begin right where they left off.
Not for them. Yeah.
There won't be any pictures on your wall.
Right. You know, so it's, yeah. But see, notice the resolution of that. You have to get them to stop making it all about them. I mean, yeah, you begin right where you left off. But the environment doesn't begin right where it left off. You know, your environment is filled with infinite ministry. You know, every possible ministry of mercy, you know, is there. You know, and the endless reminder that you cannot fall. You know, every morning you wake up to that being told to you. You know, and so, you know, it's only those that can't ever get out of self.
You're probably not born with alcoholism, if that was your problem.
Yeah, there's all kinds of things, right? Not a crack baby or whatever, yeah.
And Jerusalem is the heaven of your traditions. Right. Now, that doesn't comply with everybody's individual vision, but it's the highest thing that the sum total of humanity has conceived of. This is that and more. And it's the first step.
That book, you
know, in that one thing that you're saying, that one person, a lot of times it's because people really feel that they're not heard. And in the mansion worlds, we're going to be heard. We'll have no doubt that the beings hear and understand what we have to say. That in itself will be such a motivating thing for us.
Thank you. That's good. I like
that. All right. Well, here we kind of just presage this next section here, talking about after death. That's right where they go next. So let's see what they've got for us.
Guardian angels after death. Having told you something of the ministry of seraphim during natural life, I will endeavor to inform you about the conduct of the guardians of destiny at the time of the mortal dissolution of their human associates. Upon your death, your records, identity specifications, and the Narancha entity of the human soul conjointly evolved, by the ministry of mortal mind and the divine adjuster, are faithfully conserved by the destiny guardian together with all other values related to your future existence. Everything that constitutes you, the real you, except the identity of continuing existence represented by the departing adjuster and the actuality of personality. The instant the pilot light in the human mind disappears, the spirit luminosity which seraphim associate with the presence of the adjuster, the attending angel reports in person to the commanding angels successively of the group, company, battalion, unit, legion, and host. And after being duly registered for the final adventure of time and space, such an angel receives certification by the planetary chief of seraphim for reporting to the evening star or other lieutenant of Gabriel, in command of the seraphic army of this candidate for universe ascension. And upon being granted permission from the commander of this highest organizational unit, such a guardian of destiny proceeds to the first mansion world and there awaits the consciousizing of her former ward in the flesh.
Just one little thing before we go on, because it's always interesting to notice when they're being very specific in how they phrase this. So they point out three things upon your death. Your records, you know, like we're talking about just just recently. You know, you've got the compliment of being keeping, you know, of the guardian angel Paris keeping the records. So there's those records. Yeah, and then the third thing there, that, you know, obviously the literal soul itself, the Marantia entity. And then notice how they phrase the other part of it, the identity specifications. Because remember, we pointed out there's two things that the guardian seraphim are in charge of. One, you know, actually having your future Marantia brain, your soul, to be inserted into that body, but they also oversee the building of the Marantia body. And they do that relative to these identity specifications. You know, and why is it worded that way? You know, remember, we were kind of helping to bring out a better sense of how they use the word identity. You have a personality that has a point of identification in the cosmos energy system. Okay, there's a certain character to that energy system that is what the personality at that point of death is engaged to. They have to make sure that it picks up right where it left off. That even though it's, you know, it's going from, you know, a corporeal body to a Marantia body, nonetheless, it's structured in just such a way that it has the same essential specifications, so that that personality can re-identify with that energy system, picking up right where it left off.
Chris,
yep.
Would that also, for example, include male, female? In that particular
phrase? Right. I mean, remember, and again, that's not because personalities are male and female,
no. But
yourself is.
Right.
You know, and even though it's not going to be, you know, as distinctly twofold sexual, you know, as it is here, nonetheless, that self that personality is identifying with has, you know, is the result of the genetics and the experiences of that individual, and that's very distinct between male and female. And yeah, so, you know, so you pick up right where you left off, you know, because if it didn't have that, there's no way they could say that when you get to be a finaliter, that distinction is, you know, is still evident.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and it's, again, it's not because the father has male and female personalities. It's not your father likeness that has male and female. It's your mother likeness, you know, that is male and female.
So I have a question, and this may throw a lot of people in. What happened with individuals that haven't found that sexual identification mm-hmm. in this planet, mm-hmm. and yet they living in a man's body, but they feel like women. So, mm-hmm. What would be the likelihood of
One of the things to keep, you know, I mean, you can't say anything too specific about that because they don't give you a lot of clues, but they give you some indirect clues to reflect on relative to that. You know, we've begun to really recognize that, you know, there's very definitive male on one side and very definitive female on the other side, and then sort of everything in between. Just looking at corporeal nature. Well, what do they point out? That there's a spectrum like that coming down from on high as well. On the one hand, you have material sons and daughters who are very definitively male and female, like we understand that type of pairing. Complementary pairing. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there's seraphim that have, you know, what they call positive negative, you know, or aggressive retiring type of pairing. But it's not just two endpoints. There's a spectrum in between as well. You've got the cherubim and the primary midwayers are kind of more in the positive negative like pairing mode, but you see, the closer it gets to us, the more it's moving towards the material son and daughter type male female sort of pairing, you know. And the secondary midwayers are, you know, are in there, you know, they're pretty close to that kind of pairing, but a little bit towards the positive negative type. So there's a whole spectrum And they tell you that, you know, this came up last week too, that in terms of that, you know, there's two things that you have to experience that can't be substituted for in any other way between here and Gerasim. That's one, relationship with the opposite sex. And the other is parenting, you know, primarily to the children of the material sons and daughters. You know, and remember what it says about that parenting. It's not just ascending mortals that participate in that parenting. It's also midwares and seraphim. In other words, that whole spectrum of pairing types. So, you know, you can start to, you know, your mind can just start to run. It's like, well, so, you know, is there some presaging of that? That, you know, even when humans are serving, they're serving in a spectrum of pairing modes. And you can see that even here. You know, now you could probably say, well, maybe if it's kind of just a peculiarity of the genetics, you know, maybe it's not directly transferable. You could also argue the other way. I mean, you know, but it just opens up. At least they point out to you that, you know, that it's not like when you look beyond the earth, you don't see a spectrum of this, you know, sort of thing, where there's, on the one end, there are positive-negative pairings, an awful lot like true homosexual pairings, you know, and they may even be, hence, tuning into mind that's a little bit more towards the angelic than the material son and daughter-like end of the spectrum. And see, so, I mean, there's all kinds of things that you could bring into that, you know, thinking about that, because of the indirect things they tell you in the Revelation.
They say everything that constitutes you, the real you. Mm-hmm. So when you wake up on the other side, you recognize yourself as yourself. It doesn't matter if you're male, female, conservative, liberal, whatever.
Survival value, Jim.
Yeah. There's going to be a line of non-survival value if you get into the machinations of politics. But, you know, nevertheless, yes.
The identity specifications, just a couple of pages before, they get a little bit more specific. They say that the seraphic guardians become the personal custodians of the mind patterns, mind formulas, and soul realities of the mortal survivor. So that's three phrases there that give you a little bit of idea. Whatever you were thinking, your way of thought, your way of action, and the way that your mind worked, that's what they look at, and they say, okay, let's create a body and a mind connection and a soul connection that aligns perfectly with all of these things, even if it's sexual orientation.
Right, and see, those two statements are meant to go in parallel. See, they're, that because they're so fastidious and precise about these identity specifications, then that's what makes that mind pick up with the motion like it had, you know, where it left off.
So that goes my point. Probably a person who has been in a men's body, feeling like a woman, is going to have a woman's body right there in the mansion walls.
Well, you see, I mean, you just... it's there to speculate on. Just, you know, I mean, try to figure, you know, to try to separate, like I was saying, you know, what is the real you, you know, that can be reinstated mindily? Because Marantia substance is sort of just mind-made substance. You know, so it's the mindal you, it's not the material you, you know, that picks up right where it left off. So, you know, there's going to be some, it's a fundamentally gray. There's no way I can give you a definitive answer to what part, you know, is transferred and what isn't. I don't know.
And they talk about it.
Yeah.
No, I mean, yeah. I just think about that whole thing they say about our life is on the mansion worlds is all about working on whatever problems we have. And I kind of leave it to them to decide what those problems are. I mean, we aren't the ones who are going to get to decide, well, I think this is a defect and I think this is an asset. They have a spiritual paradigm, and they're going to say, you need to be worked on here, you know, your spark plugs aren't working, whatever it is. I mean, we are not going to be the ones who choose what gets worked on. And to me, that's actually exciting and relaxing. It's like, you know, we've struggled here, we've had to face different problems, and we've done the best we can, but then, you know, that's all we have to do. The next phase of life, we get some assistance with helping us, and however they define it.
Well, and to that, you know, if you figured something out, like you described, you know, whatever that problem is for an individual, if you figured it out 10% of the way, then, you're waking up going to 11%. But, and I think most of us would agree with that, I hope. But in terms of the sexual identity thing, I just want to throw out a thought. There's no real foundation except that there is some comment in there about humans being bisexual. I'm not sure that I ever fully comprehended it, but it's somewhere in there.
Well, so you know that the foundation of the pattern.
Yeah. No, they were referring to each individual in the way I read it, and I could be wrong.
And just, you know, the context there, you know, there's no doubt that our foundation is, you know, a reflection of the material sons and daughters, which are very definitively male and female.
Yeah.
But that's just the foundation.
Right.
You know,
not what you do.
You know, this is a downstepped expression of that, you know, and it has to meet a lot of other demands and things, and not least of which is the vicissitudes of life on a material world, where one parent can easily die, and the other parent is going to have to pick up the slack some of the other. Material sons and daughters are hopeless at that. They cannot pick up the slack of the other. They're hyper-differentiated. You know, when Eve became unplugged, Adam just goes blank. Okay? I mean, you know, he cannot just, I'll just pick up Eve's slack. No, I mean, he can't do that. Okay? They're fundamentally complemental. But, you know, you and I, you know, we're less precisely defined like that because we need to be able to pick up the slack. Well, that means there is going to be a lot of more grayness-y to the gender of humans. It's because they're purposely less precisely expressed.
Plus, you have to plug in the fact that we're just on plaid.
And there is some wild cards in that. But to your point specifically, I think that whatever is really inside of a person, irrespective of what any other of us might think about that, we're limited in what we can perceive. But the people who oversee this process are not limited so in that respect. And they're going to see whatever's there, and it's going to be applied appropriately. So, I mean, I have absolute faith, irrespective of whether I understand any of it.
All right, well, let's keep rolling. It's a huge, long conversation.
One more question on the dad issue there, because one of the things you said just wasn't quite clear about when we wake up in the mansion world, are you suggesting that in order for there to be this continuity you talked about, that, like, for instance, if someone was having a violent death, at the time of their death, they would remember that. If they died in their sleep, it would have that.
No, that didn't get transferred to the soul.
Doesn't that mean?
No, it's only the motions, the real motions, that the soul reflects.
I know I used it on a physical level, but in other words, at the moment of death, if someone's conscious, they may be going through all kinds of very intense spiritual experiences at that point and making all kinds of choices. Right, and have stuff going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's a very different type of thing than if someone dies in their sleep, right? And I just wonder, what are you...
But again, it's not, it's not the same motion. It's an equivalent motion that's reinitiated. So, I mean, it's the spirit of what was there with none of the, you know, superfluous stuff. So it's not like, you know, you're going headlong and then you're vaporized and then you wake up and you keep going headlong. You know, I mean, you know, that's stuff.
Do you remember that?
You know?
Like,
no, it's not like a transporter beam.
Spiritual experiences in that time of death, are you going to remember the material particulars?
Very unlikely that there would be much of anything, you know, that would have gotten, you know.
You died bravely.
It's like asking, if I died while I was shopping at Macy's, am I going to wake up still shopping at Macy's?
With a discount?
Yeah, but you can't take it back.
All right, anyway.
That was a meal.
And no deposit, no return, because you're not allowed to go back during your dispensation, right? All right, anyway, that's good.
In case the human soul fails of survival,
after having received the assignment of a personal angel. The attending seraphim must proceed to the headquarters of the local universe, there to witness to the complete records of her complement, as previously reported. Next, she goes before the tribunals of the archangels to be absolved from blame in the matter of the survival failure of her subject. And then she goes back to the worlds again to be assigned to another mortal of ascending potentiality or to some other division of seraphic ministry.
Just one quick thing, because I mentioned it last time. See, notice how here's an example where you appreciate in another sense why they use the term archangels for the beings that they did. Because, you know, our notion that archangel means, you know, a boss man angel, you know, is kind of here. See, you know, the run-of-the-mill angels have to go to the boss man angels, you know, the tribunals of the archangels, see. Yeah. See, so there is some truth to that, you know, as immature as our notions are along those lines. Nonetheless, there's a thread of truth there that plays out here. And then, of course, there's the other things, too, like the dispensational, you know, role of the archangel, you know, resurrection roles of the archangels and stuff like that. But just, you know, just notice how that's a simple little example where it seems like they're the, you know, the mucky muck angels, you know, even though they're really a separate, totally separate order of beings. So...
Chris, does that make sense that basically you're talking a third circle here? You know, a human fails after getting a personal angel.
Yeah. I'm, thank you for. So, I just about forgot to mention that. I'm glad you reminded me. I was gonna point that out. You know, there's another number of things here, and you'll see. Before we talk about it in details, let's read a little bit more. But notice how they're throwing in a number of these qualifications of what if. I mean, you definitely remember you can choose oblivion all the way up, you know, to 5 seconds before fusion. So,
you still have to be informed what you're talking for. It's got to be an informed decision.
Well, it's pretty darn informed if you're that close to fusion. Well, you know, there's not many blind spots left, you know. So you choose absolutely.
It doesn't seem like this planet, like we were talking earlier, the person that says, "Oh, I'm going to give up."
No. I mean, yeah.
Maybe they just don't like the fire idea.
I mean, especially post-Pentecost. Yeah. You know, like I've tried to point out a number of times, so many of the things that used to happen on mortal worlds don't happen here. You know, those issues are not in play on this mortal world anymore because it's post-Pentecost. I mean, basically, everyone survived. It's really tough to become iniquitous in, you know, 70 years and 10 or by reason of strength 80. You know, that's just a really short time to achieve iniquity. You know, you're going to have to be starting practically on the doorstep of iniquity to achieve it in that short period of time. And there's no iniquitous 6-year-old. So, I mean, most of this stuff is happening on the mansion worlds, you know.
Ready?
Yep.
But angels minister to evolutionary creatures in many ways, aside from the services of personal and group guardianship. Personal guardians whose subjects do not go immediately to the mansion worlds do not tarry there in idleness awaiting the dispensational roll calls of judgment. They are reassigned to numerous ministering missions throughout the universe.
There's another little what if. And that one should catch you. You're going, wait a minute. Personal guardians whose subjects do not immediately go to the mansion worlds. Wait a minute, I thought that's what allowed you to go immediately to the mansion worlds if you have personal guardians. Well, that's on this world, that's only true since Pentecost. Remember, that was, from the time of the rebellion up to the planetary adjudication, you know, Pentecost, that was not the case. You could have been a first circler and not immediately go on to the mansion worlds back then. I am the way, you know, as they point out, that's one of the ways in which it's very literal. He allowed that, you know, resurrection on the third period, you know, process to initiate again. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone that died from 200,000 years ago, you know, well, from 2,000 years up to Adam and Eve, and then from Adam and Eve up to, you know, to Jesus, you know, waited until the end points there. Because there were special resurrections, millennial resurrections, and stuff, you know. But, you know, there definitely could have been very, you know, there could have been third circler and beyonds who didn't get specially resurrected and went on for 40,000 years.
Wasn't John one of them? John the Baptist, was he not allowed to resurrect on the third day? Wasn't it? There was some dissension about
him. No, that was Moses.
Moses, sorry.
Moses was the special resurrection that Caligashi was contesting. Yes. It's in that spot where they mention, you know, the issue of being able to go on immediately, that was finally reinstated subsequent to Pentecost. It's right after they, you know, right before they talk about Moses. Okay.
The guardian seraphim is the custodial trustee of the survival values of mortal man's slumbering soul, as the absent adjuster is the identity of such an immortal universe being. When these two collaborate in the resurrection halls of Mansonia, in conjunction with the newly fabricated Marantia form, there occurs the reassembly of the constituent factors of the personality of the mortal ascender. The adjuster will identify you. The guardian seraphim will repersonalize you and then represent you to the faithful monitor of your earth days. And even so, when a planetary age ends, when those in the lower circles of mortal achievement are foregathered, it is their group guardians who reassemble them in the resurrection halls of the mansion spheres, even as your record tells, and he shall send his angels with a great voice and shall gather together his elect from one end of the realm to another.
Where's that? That's in Mark and Matthew. Obviously, you know where it's going to be in Matthew. It's chapter 24 of Matthew. Yeah, the infamous chapter 24 of Matthew. That occurs. I had that passage. And you'll notice how they, in just a little bit, they're going to flesh out more of the truth of from one end of the realm to another. Just hold that thought in your head as we go forward here.
The technique of justice demands that personal or group guardians shall respond to the dispensational roll call in behalf of all non-surviving personalities. The adjusters of such non-survivors do not return. And when the roll calls are called, the seraphim respond, but the adjusters make no answer. This constitutes the resurrection of the unjust. In reality, the formal recognition of the cessation of creature existence. This roll call of justice always immediately follows the roll call of mercy, the resurrection of the sleeping survivors. But these are matters which are of concern to none but the supreme and all-knowing judges of survival values. Such problems of adjudication do not really concern us.
That's
going to be really disappointing to a lot of people.
Notice how matter of fact, you know, they're trying to point out just how matter of fact they are in their actions. They are given, you know, a commission. You know, and remember, like they pointed out, even if you choose iniquity in this life and your adjuster abandons, you know, that essentially dead phenomenon, it doesn't change one iota of what your guardian seraphim are doing. You know, they continue right on. And a lot of it ties into this. I mean, they can give precise testimony that, that in spite of all appearances, you know, to the contrary, they ministered as if this was a being on the verge of fusion. Okay? Nothing changes. The hand of the mother, does not change. Even when the father withdraws his engagement, the hand of the mother, the upholder, changes not. The upholding is constant. Okay? And, the all-knowing judges, that's the ancients of days, and their ultimate microscopes of such matters of survival value, the universal sensors, you know, zeroing in and seeing if there's anything really there. If there's something there, the universal sensors will see it. If not, that's it. And here's another fun one. See where they're invoking a biblical passage. resurrection of the righteous and the wicked, you know, that's right, resurrection of the unjust. That's from Acts. That's, you know, they're pulling it out of the context there of a statement Paul makes, you know, in the Acts of the Apostles. And it's in, you know, the biblical understanding of that statement, the resurrection of the unjust, is, you know, everyone dies, they're all resurrected, these go to heaven, these go to hell. You know, you got to resurrect them before you send them to hell. You know, they're saying, well, you know, there is no hell, but there still is a resurrection of the unjust. You know, the angels don't change what they do one iota. It's just that what's resurrected is zero. You know? All of the machinery is in play. It's just that nothing materializes on the transporter pad. Okay? Nothing, because there's nothing there.
Group guardians may serve on a planet age after age and eventually become custodians of the slumbering souls of thousands upon thousands of sleeping survivors. They can also serve on many different worlds in a given system, since the resurrection response occurs on the mansion worlds.
See there? Just like, see? So think about how, you know, that passage in the Bible, you know, that seemed to be just sort of poetic flourish, you know, about elect from one end of the realm to another. No, literally, you know, these are, you know, a group seraphim. They, you know, this pair of angels may have souls from many, many planets all throughout the system that they've gathered over thousands of years, you know, where they were group guardians of all these mortals, you know, and they bring them all together from all those worlds. One end of the realm to the other. Just gives it a whole new cosmological literalness, see, what they're trying to point out. You know, that's one of the big goals of the Revelation, to show you how everything is literal. You know, every notion, expression, whatnot that we've had, you know, to see it literally. The truth of it, if there's a truth in something that humans have thought, there's a literal, factual expression, you know, at the foundation of that truth. You know, nothing is just floating in the ether of mind or something. You know, everything is literal, you know, even mind. So they love to, you know, to do that, to show you how you can reawaken, you know, the full magnitude of so many familiar things, like expressions like that passage. You know, anyone, you know, like I was mentioning Matthew 24, I mean, anyone who's a Christian who loves the notions of the end times, you know, it's that whole endless fascination is predicated on three things in the Bible. The book of Daniel, the book of the Revelation of John, and Matthew 24. You know, this is an intimate sentence, you know, to countless Christians, you know, and so, you know, they're all going to, you know, they know that they're going to recognize this, and they're saying, now see what it really means, see the truth of that, you know, made fact.
All personal and group guardians in the system of Satania who went astray in the Lucifer rebellion, notwithstanding that many sincerely repented of their folly, are to be detained on Jerusalem until the final adjudication of the rebellion. Already have the universal censors... Already have the universal censors arbitrarily taken from these disobedient and unfaithful guardians all aspects of their soul trusts and lodged these Maranta realities for safekeeping in the custody of volunteer Sakonophon.
Okay, just a little point aside. Does anyone remember what the specifics are? Now, it's a Sakonophon, so, you know, there's no possibility of rebellion in those higher angels. But, you know, is it a primary Sakonophon, a secondary Sakonophon, a tertiary Sakonophon? Is anyone? Do you remember? You know, which ones would have have someone that could take on an emergency role like this. It's the primary Sakonophin. Because if you remember, in the seven different groups, there's the reserve corps of primary Sakonophin. One of those reserve corps Sakonophin raised their hand, volunteered. That's who's doing it. And they're, this is, we mentioned last time how, when our chief of Seraphim defaulted at the rebellion, it's a higher up angel that volunteers to step in, because the higher up ones are, Integrus, and so that primary Supernaphim stepped in, he's writing this paper, stepped in to take over that role. So it's a, but the primary Supernaphim and the primary Sakonophim, you see them both playing these roles in stepping into these emergency situations.
Chris, so when Lucifer's going to be judged when all the other personalities are resurrected, so there he won't. So when they call the roll call of the resurrection of the unjust, then Lucifer will be among those.
No. This is just the mortals. The adjudication of the rebel non-mortal beings, will happen whenever the adjudication of the rebellion occurs. Now here we're just talking about, resurrection, dispensational or otherwise.
It's interesting that these rebel seraphim must have still continued to function as seraphim after they rebelled in order to...
Yeah, and you notice they pointed out, there was a number of them, they just got swept up, in the brilliance of Lucifer and Caligastian crew. And as soon as someone pointed out the facts, they went, oh my gosh, what on earth was I thinking? Well, they don't go right back to their duties. They're doing KP for the last 200,000 years. Remember, they point that out. That all those beings that did sincerely repent, none of them returned to any of their regularly scheduled duties. They're all, literally doing something like washing dishes for the last 2,000 years, and no one really knows what's going to happen. When they adjudicate the rebellion, the authorities are going to, say, okay, you can now do such and so.
They're Republicans now, aren't they?
Rehabilitating.
Right. They're in a long-term, I'm sorry, repentance mode, definitely. And they're idle hands of the devil's workshop, so they're kept very, very busy doing, grunt jobs.
They won't be given, though, positions of trust involving humans again.
Well, that's what no one knows.
Oh, we don't
know. See, that's what they say, no one really knows. It's like, what will happen when...
What happened to the human subjects when these guardians went straight?
Well, if they went astray immediately, there's others, probably. See, remember, they point out Seraphim, in an emergency, can take actions themselves, without calling upon the authorities. It's like, well, should I do something? If they see that, a ball has been dropped and, there's not time to, the communication and all that rigmarole, they would immediately step in. Nothing of value is ever lost. Some survival value is ever lost. So, most likely a lot of seraphim, loyal seraphim, would immediately stepped in. And then, like they're pointing out, when the dust finally settles and the cavalry, comes over the hill, the Sakonophim, take over those duties. There would have been a number of just like remember how the primary midwayers, immediately took it upon themselves to take care of the tree of life and stuff like that. They often, can't wait for the normal communications and, bureaucracy. They just jump right in and do what they need to do. All right, well let's do the last one here. Who wants to read this last section here? Reader. Merrick. Would you like to be?
That's it.
That was a grimace.
You want to read? Yeah, okay. That's your daughter? Okay.
Yay. Yeah. In lies. That happens.
More people asleep.
I don't fall asleep to you.
Hey, the voice of Jesus and all the personalities.
All right.
Have you read this paper before?
I'm not sure.
It is indeed an epic in the career of an ascending mortal, this first awakening on the shores of the mansion world, there for the first time actually to see your long-loved and ever-present angelic companions of earth days, there also to become truly conscious of the identity and presence of the divine monitor who so long indwelt your mind on earth. Such an experience constitutes a glorious awakening, real resurrection. On the Mirantia spheres, the attending seraphim, there are two of them, are your open companions. These angels not only consort with you as you progress through the career of the transition worlds, in every way possible, assisting you in the acquirement of the Mirantia and spirit status, but they also avail themselves of the opportunity to advance by study in the extension schools for evolutionary seraphim maintained on the mansion worlds. The human race was created just a little lower than the more simple types of the angelic orders. Therefore, will your first assignment of the Mirantia life be as assistance to the seraphim in the immediate work awaiting at the time you attain personality consciousness, subsequent to your liberation from the bonds of the flesh?
This is an interesting little thing. You're not expecting. Oh, wait a minute. I've always kind of wondered about some of those questions about what's a day in the life, of a Mirantia being, because they're pretty vague. You go to the back there where you think it might be, and here's a little thing inserted in there. So that's one of the in terms of what your one of your jobs is going to be as assistants like this. Now, the specifics are still vague, but. But at least it's like, oh, okay. I was wondering if I was going to, have to go to some big monolithic factory and punch my time card, or what the heck am I going to be doing,
Start with 10 days.
Yeah, at least there's the initial little leisure time, free time.
This is pretty poetic, They assisted us quite a bit.
That's right.
Yeah. So we're going to be assisting that. And of course, you're not just going to be assisting seraphim that are doing jobs not related to ascending mortals, So you start, so if I'm, one of the things you know that you're doing is you're always teaching, as you ascend so that you can truly learn. And they're pointing out how much the seraphim, they just said the seraphim are very much engaging you here now and really helping you, directly, interactively, right in front of you. You can see them and talk to them, and they're not just guards anymore. They're actually, directors more. So you'll be helping with that. You may be able to really offer some perspective to another ascending mortal that... neither your seraphim or their seraphim are as good at offering. And the two seraphim will coordinate to, you're not getting out of line with this engagement or whatever. So you could start to kind of speculate how it might go a little bit, what you might actually be doing.
Waxing friction shields.
Yeah, waxing. Yeah. Well, I think that's actually the KP duty that I was talking about. All of the former rebel are defaulted seraphim are waxing friction shields.
They don't get assistance.
These are our angels here on Earth, and they're just going with us, right? So we get to see them for the first time when we wake up.
Right. Now, remember, a lot of times we're speaking, if you have a personal pair.
Right.
Now, if I'm in a group of 1,000, with other 1,000 other 999 other mortals right now, and I'm with a pair of guardian angels, obviously that pair can't go with each of us.
Right.
You know, we pick up right where we left off. We're going to be regrouped up there. We're going to be whatever group, 1,500 or whatever that we were down here, we're going to be up there, but it's going to be a different pair of angels, most likely, just because, like they pointed out, a lot of these group guardians are not just working with one planet. They're working with many planets over thousands of years of time. So it's going to be pretty low probability that you're going to get the same pair if you're still in the group. You know, but eventually up there, you're going to get to a third circular,
right,
and you're going to get your own pair. You know, and there's, and like they're about
in
to talk
the next
about,
paragraph.
Yeah, yeah, they're talking about how.
Imagine that.
Boy, Don's going to want you to read every time.
Before leaving the mansion worlds, all mortals will have permanent seraphic associates or guardians. As you ascend the Morontia spheres, eventually it is the seraphic guardians who witness and certify the decrees of your eternal union with the Thought Adjusters. Together, they have established your personality identities as children of the flesh from the worlds of time. Then, with your attainment of the mature Morontia estate, they accompany you through Jerusalem and the associated worlds of system progress and culture. After that, they go with you to Edentia and its 70 spheres of advanced socialization. And subsequently, will they pilot you to the Melchizedek's and follow you through the superb career of the universe headquarters worlds. And when you have learned the wisdom and culture of the Melchizedek's, they will take you on to Salington, where you will stand face to face with the sovereign of all Nevadon. And still will these seraphic guides follow you through the minor and major sectors of the super universe and on to the receiving worlds of Uversa, remaining with you until you finally end Sakonophon for the long Habona flight. Some of the Destiny Guardians of Attachment. Some of the Destiny Guardians of Attachment during the mortal career follow the course of the ascending pilgrims through Havona. The others bid their longtime mortal associates a temporary farewell. And then, while these mortals traverse the circles of the central universe, these Guardians of Destiny achieve the circles of Seraphington. And they will be in waiting on the shores of paradise when their mortal associates awaken from the last transit sleep of time into the new experiences of eternity. Such ascending seraphim subsequently enter upon divergent services in the Finaliter Corps and in the Seraphic Corps of Completion.
Notice the attention to fine little details, you know, so that you see the parallel. Remember how just a little bit back, you know, when they were thinking about talking about you being resurrected from your mortal life, you know, and how the seraphim would be waiting there for you. You know, so that very first, you know, unconscious transition, they're waiting for you when you reawaken, you know, and the very last one. You know, see, they're very purposely giving those definitive bookends just to, you know, if it isn't totally clear that, you know, this is for the whole span. When you get to Hobona, there may be a little bit of complexity to this because you're getting at a pretty sophisticated level now, and it's not one, you know, it's one size fits all. You know, seraphim getting up to paradise have some things that they need to do that, you know, you don't have to do, and vice versa. So there can be a little bit of divergence, but in, you know, when all is said and done, they'll be waiting there for you when you awaken. Paradise, just like they were waiting for you the very first time. Yeah. Did everyone feel it too in that previous paragraph? You know, every time they say this, where you will stand face to face with the sovereign of Nevadon. Mm. It's hard to even say it out loud. Yeah, is that not the coolest thing? You know, it's hard to, you know, even hold that thought in your head stably. You know, just to picture that. You know, yeah. As he came all the way down here, yeah, he's waiting there, and he'll be there when you get there. Yeah, pretty cool.
Just on that point. Some people every once in a while might meet a politician like governor or senator or president or something in a lifetime, but not very many people do. Mm-hmm. So you think about that statement you just pointed out. Yeah. Every single pilgrim meets Michael
in all of Salvington.
In all of Salvington. That's a very personalized universe we're talking about.
A lot of handshaking.
Fantastic.
Yeah. People of roughly 10 million worlds.
Yeah, and again, see, because it's so powerful to us, you know, relative to some sort of a, you know, a Christian idea or something, because we know the cosmology, the extent, as well as the intent of that statement. You know, it's so vast and yet so personal. I mean, it's, that's what makes it so magnificent. You know, a thought to hold in your mind. You know, and only the revelation, see, brings in, you know, that cosmos along with that personal, you know, intensity, you know, that we've long understood. And so now all of these things are so much more glorious when you contemplate them.
There's a lot of compression.
Just how amazingly cool is that, you know? That you are not lost in that massive haystack. You know?
Well, if you're an extrovert, it's cool.
A lot of that introvert stuff, you know, might get sloughed off too.
Aren't introverts just cool further, inside?
Taking it a step further, the Son is the Father and the Son are one in you, as seeing the Son has seen the Father. And the Son is the personal representative of the personal Heavenly Father, not God, the Heavenly Father. So it gives us an idea of the Father's interaction with his universe children, and our eventual journey to paradise.
Absolutely.
And the kind of personal touches this universe really has, and it gives a scope and understanding of what a God of love really does look like.
That was actually the next thing I was just going to point out. See, that take that to that next notch. I mean, why is it that way? Because he is. You know, he was seeing me, he has seen the Father, and you know, the universal Father loves you, engages you as if you are the only being in all of infinity. When he looks at you, there is no one else. Because the love is not even hugely relative. It's absolute. You know, that means there is no one else. There's no relativity to his connection to you. He loves you as if you're his only child in all of infinity and eternity.
But you know? Isn't that the way that we feel in our relationship with the Father and the relationship that we have as we speak with Michael of Nevadon? Isn't that the way that we build in this very special, intimate relationship?
Yeah, and just see how, you know, your point, like I was trying to point out, you know, the thing that the rebels are constantly trying to show you is how it's more than an inspiring truth. There's you know, if it's true, there's a literal factual expression of it. You know, you literally, each person stand in front of he who has seen me has seen the Father. Because if you didn't, that would be false. It wouldn't be true that when you see him, you'd seen the Father. He would meet you in groups then. But no, it's literally true. You have there's a has to be an absolutely one-on-one, face-to-face, for it to be true that he who has seen me has seen the Father.
That's what made it so powerful when he was on Earth here in his public ministry. I mean, that was just people who were in his presence. You know, it was immediate decision time.
No longer were you looking through the, you know, the conduit of the third cosmic intuition to see the Father. You were looking with these, right there, you know. And of course, that's a double-edged sword. You know, remember what Jesus says, you know, when he's doing the woe unto you. You know, I mean, this isn't just some abstract thing that you're doing. The Father is standing right in front of you. And you are rejecting him. That's the end. There is no hope because you've just made an absolute choice. Because it's nothing blurry. It's not like I'm saying, you know, ignorance is not, you know, does not lead to damnation. I mean, there's nothing, he's literally standing there. There's no, you know, veil over it. Right there, you're engaging it in all of its truth. Yeah. Yeah. And that was only true when he was literally standing there in front of them. You know? Just like so many other things were only literally true when you had a creator being literally here in the flesh. all, you know, the bridge between time and eternity, it was bridged right there. No gap between time and eternity anymore. It's standing right in front of you in this moment of time. All of eternity is standing right there. Choose all of it or none of it.
This has been a great discussion of this point. It makes it more real for all of us, more actual. And we can conjecture surviving death, all those trials and experiences we may have as we progress. We can imagine getting all the way to paradise in terms of the work and the going. But the part we can't imagine, because we haven't done it yet, is the real attainment at each level. Because you're not standing in front of Michael because it's finally time and it's your turn and you've waited in line all this time. It's because within, in your relationship with God and with the Father and Mother of the universe and with all the people that you've worked with and teamed with and been instructed by, you have attained, and not in any ego sense of that, you have attained that, and when you attain it, you find yourself right there, knowing and receiving what it is.
Again, see, because everything is literal. You're not standing there because you want to stand there. You're standing there because you can.
Right.
And before that, you couldn't. Right. And the same is true when you get to paradise. The only time you stand in the presence, you know, of the central, you know, sphere, domain of the aisle is when you can. Like they tell you, if you just imagined, you know, getting your wish answered and being taken there, there would be no experience.
Right.
You know, because you actually can't stand there. You know, it's a thought experiment only. You know, but if you say, well, let's imagine that I could, what would I see? Nothing. Because you actually can't. It's literal.
Man and angel may or may not be reunited in eternal service, but wherever seraphic assignment may take them, the seraphim are always in communication with their former lords of the evolutionary worlds, the ascendant mortals of time. The intimate associations and the affectionate attachments of the realms of human origin are never forgotten, nor ever completely severed. In the eternal ages, men and angels will cooperate in the divine service as they did in the career of time. For seraphim, the surest way of achieving the paradise deities is by successfully guiding a soul of evolutionary origin to the portals of paradise. Therefore, is the assignment of guardian of destiny the most highly prized seraphic duty. Mm-hmm. Only destiny guardians are mustered into the primary or mortal core of the finality. And such pairs have engaged in the supreme adventure of identity at oneness. The two beings have achieved spiritual bi-unification on Seraphington prior to their reception into the finality core. In this experience, the two angelic natures, so complementary in all universe functions, achieve ultimate spirit two-in-oneness, repercussing in a new capacity for the reception of and fusion with a non-adjuster fragment of the Paradise Father. And so do some of your loving seraphic associates in time also become your finaliter associates in eternity, children of the Supreme and perfected sons of the Paradise Father.
Presented
by the Chief of Seraphim, Station on your ranch.
Okay, and notice the beautiful parallel here. How this paper ends is exactly how the previous paper ended. First one talking about you, this one talking about the angels. You know, just to re-stress, I, when we read that end of the last paper, I tried to really stress that, you know, that they're presaging what they're really going to begin to talk more about, you know, in the Supreme Papers. That, yes, there is the father likeness in play. Universe, but there is also the mother likeness in play. And they're and see, and again, how carefully they worded exactly the same way. In the previous one, it said, you know, you're going to serve in your true characters, children of the supreme God of experience and divine sons of the paradise father of all personalities. Okay? Children of the supreme and perfected sons of the paradise father. So you and I start with very little mother-like character. And the full infinity of father-likeness is inserted into us. Okay? And then we spend from here to eternity growing that mother-like character. Being more of a nature that can be part of the all-are. Because you're given right at the beginning everything you need to be an infinite part of the I am. Qualitatively infinite part of the I am. But notice, see, it's the other way around for, you know, this first phase of things with the seraphim. I mean, they're daughters of God. They're very much, especially when you're talking about the seraphim serving in this role as ministers to ascending mortals. You know, they are ministering mother likeness because that's where they're coming. Where they come from. You know, if they're a seraphim, they're children of the creative mother spirit. You know, and they have that mother like deity as part of their nature. If they're a primary seraphim, they're children of the reflective mother spirits. You know, and have that mother like deity as a reflection of them. And see, so, you know, the sum of your loving seraphic associates, you know, those that, you know, that really have this whole long thing of growing their mother likeness with no intimate father likeness internally in play, and then at the end, they get the fragment, right. The father fragment.
Mm-hmm.
See, so they get the father fragment at the end, and the mother proceeds, and we get the father fragment at the beginning, and then the mother part follows. So they're showing you the parallel here, you know, and so and that's really important because look at the context they're telling you that it's, you know, it's serving in the core of the finality. You know, you begin to recognize and see how you have a complementary role then in the core of the finality. How you know, each of you represents, you know, this fundamentally different perspective of how you brought experiential, you know, relationship to experiential deity into you. You know, did you do it, you know, sort of really bootstrapping, and then the father, you know, confirms that at the end? Or did the father infinitely spark it at the beginning, you know, and then off it went, you know? And the kind of experiential wisdom that we have to offer is fundamentally reciprocal then, because of that fundamentally reciprocal character of how we grew to be part of the core of the finality.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, in the same way that, you know, in the next age, you know, we'll have a reciprocal, as finaliters, we have a reciprocalness with Creator's sons. You know, because they went from the top all the way down and we went from the bottom all the way up. You know, all, you know, they're just pointing out another of these, you know, wonderful, complementary, reciprocal pairings. All right, so,
can I just make an announcement really quickly?
Oh, well, wait, no, we'll do that after. We just let's wrap up here first. So just notice, you know, it's only sons when they're talking about he. It's child when you're talking about she. You know, they're very careful about that. Like I said, when we go into the Supreme Papers, you know, we'll see that when they're talking. And they're talking about that future he-ness of the supreme being, that absonite being. You know, it's he, and your relationship there as a seven-stage spirit is a son to that supreme being. But prior to that, you're a child of the universal mother. They're very, very careful about that, distinguishing the language there. All right, so and then speaking of that mother-father, like I pointed out, so we've got these two papers. We just finished. What does it look like when seraphim are functioning in a mother-like ministry mode? Now the next paper, what's it like when they're functioning in the father-like ministry mode? You know, when it's more of this intervention, this injection into, you know, into affairs. They're going to do the same thing that they were just doing here. They're going to take some biblical passages, you know, maybe just a few words, and they're going to point out, you know, what are the real facts behind the truth of that passage. And like I mentioned, it's, you know, one of those points where they do that is really startling. it is the ultimate counterpoint to all of this enveloping, mother-like, you know, even with the rugged hills and all that sort of stuff, nonetheless, you know, they are just there, you know, giving you everything you could possibly need. And then there's when they're in the other mode, okay? And they can definitely turn it around. And they point out, you know, and they're functioning with the Most High Observer, who rule in the kingdoms of men, takes a very different, I think it can take on a very different character than warm and cuddly, okay? So they're, you know, because, you know, we all know that there are some images like, you know, Archangel Michael statues. What's he usually holding?
A sword.
Yeah. Not a blanket. Okay. Sword.
Not a snuggie.
Okay. Yeah. We're talking about angels, not archangels, but they can take up that other mode.
Why do they have the designations of battalion and army?
Right. Like you said, yeah. Mm-hmm. Those kind of presage that.
It'd be interesting to hear the real translation of that at a later date.
All right, so let's just take a moment here and some quiet time.